From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Congressman Tom Garrett, a Republican from the state of Virginia, and we're coming to you from his office on Capitol Hill. In 2016, Congressman Garrett was elected to represent Virginia's 5th Congressional District. Before running for Congress, Tom Garrett served in the U.S. military as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army. He served on active duty as an artillery officer for 6 years. His service took him overseas to Germany and Bosnia-Herzegovina. After serving in the U.S. Armed Forces, Congressman Garrett entered public service as a civilian in 2007, serving for 10 years in various official capacities in the state of Virginia. As a freshman member of the U.S. Congress, Tom Garrett serves on the House of Representatives Committees on Homeland Security, Foreign Affairs, and Education and the Workforce. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Congressman Garrett, who is not running for re-election, about a range of domestic and international issues facing the United States and the world. We'll also get his take on the upcoming midterm elections, where analysts say Democrats, the minority party, are slated to pick up a significant number of seats in the House of Representatives. Well, first I'd like to ask you about your district, Congressman Garrett, and your time here on Capitol Hill in the House of Representatives. What prompted you actually to run for office in the first place?
So in sort of my value core, you have to have a north-seeking arrow, you know, some sort of true north. And for me, it's always been a desire to lead a life that was meaningful, where I did something that was worthwhile. And so for any number of years, I guess 10 or 12, it's manifested itself in elected office and trying to shape policy. And that was it. How much can I do with the finite amount of time that I have on the planet to make sure that somehow it's better when I'm gone? And that was really sort of the voice, the nudging.
And talk about your district in terms of its composition. Is it more Republican, Democratic, women, men? You know, what's the...
Well, I think that...
What are the issues?
The analysts have it as an R+5. We won by 17. I was proud to... I think we picked up about 8 or 9% of the voters for Ms. Clinton on top of those that Mr. Trump got. But to really understand the district, it's the best congressional district in America. You've probably heard that before. But it is. Okay, so let me tell you why. There was a guy who wrote a document called the Declaration of Independence who lived in the 5th District of Virginia. Thomas Jefferson at Monticello. There was another fellow who ran to be the representative from the 1st District and lost, named James Monroe, who was obviously instrumental in a paramount piece of American foreign policy later. He ran against another fellow who drafted a document called the Constitution named James Madison. The Civil War, where America reunited, ended in the 5th District. The Civil Rights Movement in Virginia really began in the 5th District when a 16-year-old girl was the only student initiator of a case that was amalgamated into Brown versus Board of Education. So I'm a history nerd, right? You've probably picked up on that already. Booker T. Washington was born in Hales Ford in the 5th District. So when I drive around the district, I'm inundated by the idea that amazing people like Barbara Johns, like James Madison, were there. James Madison represented the district, so it's a great honor, and it's a neat district historically, and it's a place where you can sort of see that progress. In the preamble to the Constitution, we talk about forming a more perfect union, and I like the words forming and more, because they imply a perpetual responsibility, that this is not a fait accompli. And then when you study on somebody like Barbara Johns, who we're trying to get a Congressional Gold Medal for posthumously, because people should know who she was, and you realize that here's a student who, by virtue of the courage of her convictions and an education, a lot of which came from an inadequate school that she let a student walk out from, and some other came from her uncle Vernon Johns, who James Earl Jones played in a film, understood that if all people are created equal, that there shouldn't be a separate high school. One high school where the heat worked and one where it didn't. One high school where the roof didn't leak and one where it did. So this is the American journey that's embodied by the 5th District.
Well, you certainly have a deep interest in history and world affairs by virtue of your background as well. Let's talk about President Trump and his view of the world. He's been very outspoken about what he calls America First, and he's not a big fan of globalization, notwithstanding, you know, here we are, and we do need to mitigate its downsides. Nonetheless, I'd like to get your view, your assessment of President Trump's policies, foreign policies, and domestic policies. Where do you converge? Where do you differ?
Well, you know, if the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, then every problem becomes a nail. I get this sort of America First angle from a political perspective. It's sort of that people felt left out as we witnessed the economic downturn coming out of the Bush administration and really sort of persisted through the Obama years. And so it was, hey, I care about you and I'm going to prioritize you. I think that the message lacks nuance. Having said that, and we're going to talk, you said maybe about midterms later. Well, we oversimplify everything, right? So the midterms are going to boil down, there'll be trends, but they're going to boil down to a district by district, candidate by candidate. This America First thing, as a sort of a macro, makes sense to Americans. But, you know, it was Mattis who said you can either do foreign aid or buy more bullets.
Right, and you're referring, of course, to Defense Secretary Jim Mattis.
Sure, and if the president is listening to people like that, then despite sort of the, I would say, sometimes hyperbolic and arguably bellicose rhetoric, I think it'll be moderated. And the other thing is, and this is funny because I always tell people this discussing Iran, but you need to listen not just to what they say to the outside world, you need to listen to what they say in Farsi to the Iranian people. And so we need to understand and differentiate between sort of political rhetoric and policy. And I don't know, candidly, that the president does a great job. And I don't think, and this is not their responsibility, that the media parses it for him. I've said earlier in the administration, because I tend to agree with the president, certainly not always, I am getting tired of saying I think I know what he meant. And that's tough.
That's a very good point. And that leads us into more specific policies toward various regions. And it is no secret that Mr. Trump has, in many ways, alienated many of our stalwart allies and sort of cozied up to what we would call dictators, whether it's Kim Jong-un of North Korea and a few others. And another policy, which is imposing tariffs on allies as well as adversaries, many people, both Republicans and, of course, Democrats, have said that these tariffs aren't really helping Americans, even if that is Mr. Trump's intention. We're seeing headlines now, steelmakers.
Sure.
Here, American steelmakers. Where's the benefit to these tariffs? So your view on that particular policy of imposing tariffs to help American industry when, in fact, we don't see that. We don't see it necessarily in the short term and certainly possibly not in the long run.
Well, I think I've got this figured out, right? So maybe breaking news. The negotiations that I've seen from the White House manifest themselves primarily in the same way. It's not tariffs that will help the American people. I'm anti-tariff. It's the credible threat of tariffs that will strike better deals. I've seen a bipartisan assortment of groups come out in support of the new NAFTA, which the name escapes me off the top. It's, I think the ink's still wet. And that tells you something. So it's not the tariff, it's the credible threat of the tariff. And the Trump negotiation tactic, from my observation, is figure out the most important thing to the person with whom you're negotiating, threaten to deny it to them, and then say, but I'm flexible. To me, this isn't hard. So I watched when the tariff tough talk came out, and then I watched people peel off and go, oh, the sky is falling. And I thought, give this thing 6 months. There's a weakness to democracy that I would not exchange, and that is that when you do not centrally plan, it's hard to play the long game. The Great Leap Forward cost millions and millions and millions of lives, but there was a goal that was 100 years out. And lockstep, a series of leaders have autocratically sort of moved towards that. Well, a weakness of democracy is that we tend to shift with administrations. Having said that, we have to understand the long game. Was it Churchill credited with saying democracy is the worst system of government in the world except for all the others? So I like what we got. It's better to empower people, and the way to get the best with the collective is to empower the individual. But we need to look past the threat of tariffs and ask ourselves, what's the goal? And I think we're going to get better trade deals. I think that's already beginning to manifest itself. Perhaps a messaging shortcoming at some level. Having said that, one of the things, and I can speak to this on levels I'm not allowed to speak to this, it's put us in positions to make some real global security gains, is the fact that potential adversaries have no idea what the heck is going to happen next. Because that's Trump, right? I mean, there's just no paradigm by which this thing works. But I do believe that's his negotiation tactic. Scare the hell out of him and then say, but I'm flexible, go to the table, and then extract half of what you originally asked for.
With respect to the new NAFTA accord, many experts are saying that it's really not a whole lot different than the previous one. And it took a lot of angst and so on to get here. But leave that aside for a moment. What about China? I know you're very interested in China and its tentacles around the world, particularly in the region. Very dangerous for democracy, very dangerous for the region. Some analysts would say that if President Trump had endorsed the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, that that actually would have been good, not just economically for the United States and its allies in the region, but also strategically. And yet, he disavowed it and he's imposing tariffs. and all the Chinese are doing are retaliating in kind. Where is that going?
Well, what I want to see, because TPP had some good stuff in it, and I got a huge agricultural sector in my district, and in that arena in particular, there was good stuff. But, you know, I always like to say the road to hell is paved with omnibus legislation, and this would include multilateral international trade agreements. There are so many different silos in TTP that I think we have the bandwidth to walk and chew gum at the same time, that we can do ag separately from textiles, that we can do automobiles separately from tech products. And so I don't have a problem with that. But if you're going to throw that baby out, you can't throw out the bathwater too. You need to go back to the table and start working on those agreements. We've seen some of that. Good trade policy is good foreign policy, which is good security policy. What undergirds all of it, I would argue, is good human rights policy, because people want someone to do business with who have values that they can emulate, and the people from whom all power flows, even in autocratic regimes, inherently sort of yearn for basic dignities and freedoms. Now, there's two aid models. I'm digressing a little bit, but we can circle right back around to the ASEAN region, to TTP. There's a US aid model wherein we give aid, whether it's PEPFAR, attacking HIV/AIDS in Africa with wonderfully documented results, or school feeding programs, which are getting particularly young women into classrooms in strife-torn regions across Africa in particular, but not exclusively. The U.S. aid goes to the people. The Chinese aid goes to the autocrats, the dictators. I was in the presidential palace in Khartoum, probably is about as big as the Cannon House office building. And it was built exclusively and entirely by the Chinese to ingratiate them to Omar al-Bashir and to the NIS and the regime. Now, the U.S. aid model works better where people are empowered. It doesn't work in an autocratic regime, because while all power ultimately is given, I believe, from a supreme power, regardless of your belief structure, to people, and then flows from people by the consent of the governed to the government. And again, even in a communist or an autocratic regime, but because the Bolshevik Revolution had to happen for there to be regime change, which came from what? The people. So we need to rethink our aid paradigm if we're not going to encourage global acceptance of basic human rights norms. If we do the latter, encourage global acceptance of basic human rights norms, and the world has to compare Chinese aid versus American aid, they're coming to us. But again, this is a long game question, and it was Vandenberg in 1948 who said politics should stop at the water's edge. I've thoroughly enjoyed my time on the Foreign Affairs Committee. We've lost it. Everything has become Russia and egregious Russian meddling in our elections, which goes back at least to 84, and I would argue to 1919-ish. But the goal wasn't to swing the election for Mr. Trump or Ms. Clinton. The goal was to pit Americans against Americans. And if that was their goal, they've succeeded beyond, I would imagine, their wildest expectation. We need to dwell on that which unites us and not divides us, and think about what we have that makes us special and good. And not we as America exclusively, but democratic, pro-human ideas.
I'll pick up on some of your points in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. We're talking with Congressman Tom Garrett, a Republican from the state of Virginia. He serves on the House Foreign Affairs, Homeland Security, and Education Committees. I'm Carol Castiel, and this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find that download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a big shout out to Stephen Gotswill from Taraba State in Nigeria.
Wow.
Thanks so much for writing in, Stephen. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Congressman Garrett. And you brought up Russia, so I do want to pick up on that.
Sure.
And I do take your point. No question they have been meddling in our elections, in the elections of Europeans for the past decade, perhaps previous to that, but we have never seen anything quite like Vladimir Putin, and all of our intelligence agencies have concluded that. They did interfere. That's a foreign adversary interfering in the U.S. election to help Donald Trump and to hurt Hillary Clinton. We shall see what will come.
I take exception with, based on my reading, right? And I'll tell you this. I believe it was the Los Angeles Times, it might have been the New York Times, that documented very thoroughly one Senator Ted Kennedy reaching out to the Soviet Union in 1983-84 saying, we want to work with you to help defeat Ronald Reagan for re-election. I'm not making this up. You can Google it. So there's a long pattern of collusion. This collusion, again, is, what we have is bots, trolls. You know, I'm not running for re-election, and I get 10 new followers a day on Twitter who have no posts ever. Why are they coming to me, right?
Sure.
And that's so they can echo things that tear us apart, that sort of drive emotion. and pit us one against the other, look, it's good to disagree, because in disagreement we have debate, and in debate we find solutions. But we don't need to hate and turn on one another.
But I want to pick up on your point where we both converge and where most people agree, and that is that they are interfering, that is the Russians, Vladimir Putin's Russia, should sow discord, and whether through social media and other means. Mm-hmm. We'll see. There's a lot of criminal indictments, but we're going to let that go for a moment. And just talk about the threat from Russia. You talked about China and their lack of respect, obviously, for democracy. That is not a democracy. Russians have elections. They are not free and fair elections.
Right.
That's elections in name only.
Right.
The true underpinnings of democracy do not exist. A free press, an independent judiciary, the ability to speak one's mind, and real elections governed
sure.
by the rule of law. But we're seeing a trend in the Republican Party sort of giving Russia more of a pass. How do you see this transition in terms of the perception of Russia as an adversary, particularly with Vladimir Putin invading countries like Ukraine, annexing Crimea?
Right.
This is upending the post-Second World War order and many other nefarious activities.
Well, what we've seen, though, is a greater leveraging of global Magnitsky, where I'd like to use it more. We've seen the sort of aid flowing to Ukraine that the Ukrainians have been clamoring for 8-9 years. So I would argue that we've gotten a lot tougher on Russia. Having said that, as it relates to Republicans giving Russia a pass, what I think I see, and this may just be a difference in perception, is a real desire to understand if the apparatuses of the federal government were weaponized against private citizens and political campaigns in conjunction with political campaigns. Anybody who I respect isn't saying there wasn't Russian meddling, but I would differentiate between meddling and collusion. Collusion implies essentially conspiracy between more than one party. Meddling implies they're messing with us. We know they were.
That's right. We do. And you're right. We're waiting to see, you know, what other evidence may appear.
We've been waiting a while.
Mueller's probe. Exactly. But we shall see. Let's move on, because you have so much to talk about. You have such fascinating insights, particularly on Iran, for example.
Sure.
Do you agree with President Trump's approach to Iran? Really a far more hard line than the previous administration, pulling out from the deal, etc.
We've had this thing licked for 24 years. If the ISA from the 90s had had teeth, but it was our allies, our close historical allies, primarily in Europe. And right now, I will name Sweden and Austria and Italy, who are sort of doing workarounds. The Germans have done this. I think they've gotten a lot better. It's tough economically to say, hey, Germany, choose between us and Iran, because we need Germany too, right? You can be not a globalist and recognize global interdependence. You'd be stupid not to. But that's what we have to do, because once people understand that, hey, that the United States means it, it's a no-brainer.
So you agree with having withdrawn from the Iran
Iranian
nuclear
people
accord.
Want, because economically, all the money that comes in gets funneled straight through the IRGC, who exports it in the form of weapons and bloodshed. Look, Hezbollah is the wholly owned subsidiary of Iran. They have murdered human beings on every inhabited continent on the planet. Name me another terror organization that's covered Australia, Oceania, Asia, Africa, Europe, South America, North America. And so they get sanctions relief, they get oil revenue, and it doesn't do anything for the Iranian people. And so the problem that I see with Iran, and it drives me crazy, is you got people who were supporters of the Shah who don't want to work with the MEK. The MEK, formerly communist, I would argue that they attempted to sort of brand, who won't work with the supporters of the Shah. There are all these disparate dissident groups. Can we not agree that something is better than the status quo? When students look, there are people demonstrating right now 400 yards away, and I totally disagree with them. But I wore a uniform and risked my life to defend their right to protest. You should be able to walk the street in your country and call your government out. So the Iranians want this. We have to create the conditions for success. And when I speak to my friends in the Iranian dissident community, they know there'll be bloodshed, but none of them want it to be vis-a-vis American tanks rolling across the border or bombs raining down on Tehran. Look, if you do convert for population, adjust for population, the number of people killed by the regime since 1979 in Iran is comparable to the number of Americans who died in the entire Second World War.
Some critics are saying that the saber rattling and these reimposed sanctions could very well lead to another war or bloodshed, and are concerned about that.
So the most imminent threat of global calamity would be a North Korean nuclear situation, right? But the most reasonably predictable threat of nuclear calamity is nuclear Iran. Here's why. Mutually assured destruction was a doctrine that worked really well when you were dealing with an atheist regime who didn't believe in an afterlife. Going back to what I said about what's said in Farsi to the Iranian people by the mullahs. In fact, in Iran, they have free and fair elections. They absolutely do. But I think 403 people wanted to run for president when Rouhani ran. The mullahs approved four, right? So they got to pick which ones that they wanted people to get to choose from. So you have a different paradigm where there's a religious extremism that at least has paid lip service into a microphone about wanting to destroy Israel, about wanting to destroy the United States. The paradigm worked. We knew that if anybody pressed that button, we were all gone and nobody wanted to do it. I don't give that credit to the mullahs. So we need to get this one right for two reasons. Number one, while I represent the 5th District of Virginia and the United States of America, but human beings are human beings, and human beings in Iran have been suffering for two generations. And number two, the long-term calamity regionally and globally is almost predictable. And the North Koreans have they sell people, coal, and missile and nuclear technology. They will deal with the Iranians they already have. So we need to get this right, and that means putting some pressure on and insisting that our allies join us.
Are you in favor of President Trump's approach to North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un?
If you can find me somebody who doesn't think we're in a better spot as far as imminent crisis emanating from Korea than we were 2 years ago, I'd like to talk to him. Again, I mean, I have to tip my hat to the president insofar as sometimes he zigs when I would have zagged, but right now we're in a better spot than we were in. Having said that, if you understand this part three of the Kim dynasty, these guys are sort of legend at making a deal and then going the other direction. 1994, President Clinton strode to a podium and said, this North Korean nuclear deal, sound familiar, has ensured that we won't see nuclear conflagration emanating from the Korean Peninsula. We eased sanctions, we let up, and what they did was essentially perpetuate the regime. So I'm glad we're talking. Know with whom you're talking. Understand history in order to predict the future. I was in Korea during the bilateral talks in Pyongyang, and I was very frustrated with some of the tact that Moon took because I felt like we weren't on the same page.
President of South Korea.
That's correct. Having said that, one of the things I said to I won't name high-ranking South Korean official, was you can't sell our house and we can't sell yours. Right? You can't negotiate the sale of our car and we can't negotiate the sale of yours. Having said that, there's been, albeit a tenuous, peace, although not officially, for 70 years by virtue of an agreement, not just between the United States and South Korea, but the UN.
Before we move into domestic issues to close, Congressman Garrett, quickly, your views on what's going on with this Rohingya crisis, the terrible situation. This is a Muslim minority group in Myanmar who have been brutally attacked by the Burmese military, and we're still in a very dire situation where they feel unsafe going back, and I'd like to get
there's nothing views. To go back to. In some instances, the villages essentially are razed, and now you've got Bangladesh, who's really stepped forward and providing refuge and assistance, and you're talking about a country that's one of the poorest in the region. And the breakneck pace, now the Rohingya crisis goes back to the Myanmar constitution. It's old, but it's really been stepped up recently. As I spoke to before the interview, there's a China sort of one belt, one road interest driving this, which manifests itself also in a wedge being driven between the U.S. and Myanmar. Having said that, we have a duty to condemn this sort of atrocity. I think Global Magnitsky again provides, and we've got, what, three generals and two police chiefs. We should expand that target list. But it provides a scalpel wherein we can sanction those in Myanmar who are perpetrating this evil without bludgeoning our relationship with Myanmar. It can be a stick, but only in very select instances. What's going on, though, and people need to understand, again, the Constitution doesn't even recognize the Rohingya as people. We had, what, a three-fifths compromise in this country? But
for our African-American.
Right, and then he dreads God. And, I mean, you know, so again, I like to point out, and I love this country, and I think it's the greatest country in the world, but if you want to acknowledge your failings, then it's hard to talk about your successes, at least and be credible. The difference is we sort of move forward from this. So I would ask Myanmar to relook their constitution right now. I think we should target the individuals responsible for these atrocities, and I think we need to call the Chinese to bear. All sorts of embargoes and that sort of things involving the implements of this brutality, grant you that machetes are as commonly used as rifles, but the Chinese are making money not just selling weapons to Myanmar military, but to the rebels. And I don't understand the calculus on the part of the Myanmar military, because when you destroy a family, destroy a home, rape, murder, etc., you breed extremism that manifests itself later. So this is a tough one, but the first thing you got to do is pull back the onion and see who's pulling the strings. Then you have to make specific demands. We're not hegemonic. We're not going to, if you don't revise your constitution, then there'll be troops on the ground. That's ridiculous. But if we want to do business with you, Myanmar, we can't do business with you until you recognize the fundamental right of people in your society to be citizens. These are baby steps, but they're reasonable steps. And candidly, again, if we're credible and uphold our word, which I would point to Japan and Korea as examples of where we've done that, then people are going to want to work with America, not China, in a bilateral paradigm. But where America is all over the place and doesn't understand root causes, they have no choice.
Well, back to the USA, Tom Garrett, and we know you're not running again, and yet the midterms are coming up. I'd like to get your view on how do you think the Republicans are doing heading into the midterms? We see many other members of Congress, like yourself, leaving Congress. They're not going to be running again. They're concerned. We talk about a so-called Democratic wave. We'll see if that actually manifests itself. But Democrats are likely to gain seats. Usually the party out of power does in a midterm congressional election. How do you see this playing out?
We want to, for the consumer of news, everything's nationalized, and obviously you're international, but we want to say this is what's going to happen across America. That's a tempting thing to do. It saves time. It's going to be local, though. I mean, you're going to see individual candidates outperform trends. You're going to see individual candidates who should be in safe districts lose races. The candidate does matter. And really, issues that are very important in one district or another, let's just say, like, for example, border security in Texas versus border security in Ohio, or tariffs in Ohio versus tariffs in Texas. So if the Democrats don't gain seats, I'll be shocked. I still think that the Republicans will hold the House. I'm the only person I hear saying that. Having said that, I'm wrong all the time. Right? I mean, I've never predicted one of my own races wrong because I've never lost, but it's local.
What about your seat? Do you think it's vulnerable?
No, I don't think so. I got the most votes of any candidate in history running in that district ever for any office, including president.
So it's likely to stay Republican?
It was R5 on paper, but I mean, Trump won it by 9. We won it by 17. The gubernatorial nominee who lost for the Republicans won it by like 10. I don't know how it's still R5. I think this is one of those districts that's trending towards Republicans. There's sort of a move by the working class voter that's totally antithetical to what I understood in 1985 towards the Republican Party. We had an amazing textile industry. It's gone. The tobacco industry was massive. It's gone. People who were proud and had been prosperous and had been an economic engine in Virginia that don't have it anymore. And this Trump sort of America first kind of we're bringing these jobs back rhetoric, it strikes home. The more elections I predict, the more times I'm wrong. But I don't see how this district moves. And I can tell you that there are a million reasons I'm not running again, but one of them didn't think I would win.
Well, tell us, Tom Garrett, what do you plan to do after you leave Congress? You have such a background and so many interests.
You know, my real passion is the civil society, global basic human rights. And I can get just as fired up advocating on behalf of Chaldean or Syrian Christians in northeast Syria or northern Iraq as I can for Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar or Falun Gong or Uyghurs in China. Just basic fundamental freedoms. You haven't asked about this, but I'll go there. You know, 2 years in Congress, the thing that I did that I'm proudest of didn't have anything to do with the bill. We learned that there were two pastor and a seminarian who was actually apostated, converted from Islam to Christianity in Sudan, being held in prison ostensibly for aiding rebels. I would argue that it was for giving food and medicine to their neighbors. And they spent about 2 years there. We got engaged. To the Sudanese government's credit, they were willing to listen, and we ended up working with them. And now those two individuals and seven family members live in the 5th District of Virginia. They're expecting twins, the husband and wife are. And one of the coolest things I've ever done was going to the International Arrivals Gate at Dulles Airport and meeting those two men. The family had been here. That's what I want to do. I'm a policy wonky kind of guy, and I think I can do more to influence good policy and aid in sort of a civil society kind of prioritization globally outside of Congress than I can in it. I think if you establish a subject matter expertise and rapport and relationships, which I have across the aisle, that you can move more votes as an information source than you can as a vote. So that's what I want to do. I don't have anything nailed down. I've got a million ideas. And I think people say, what do you want your job to be? And I say, I don't want a job. I want five of them. So I think it might manifest itself in a lot of different areas.
Well, that couldn't be any more American than that. Congressman Tom Garrett is a Republican from the state of Virginia. Congressman, thanks so much for taking your time, talking with us on so many issues. And we wish you the very best of luck and success.
We're going to be all right. Yeah, it's an interesting time to be alive.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer and producer was Ted Schneider, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.